So much for cutting all her hair off in a whim. I pocketed the card. The next drawer had only a stack of manila folders held together with a rubber band. I put them on the desktop and went through them quickly. They were all candidate files, application packages put together by those who came to Anna Buckley looking for a job. The job it would be Sarah's responsibility to find. I flicked through a few files at the top of the stack. Each had a small ID photo printed in the top right-hand corner underneath the candidate's name. Nearly every one was a man in his 20s who looked like a boy in his teens, complete with the odd spot, oversized shirt collar and excessive hair gel application. Or a young woman with bad eye makeup and bedhead hair that she had probably spent an hour teasing into position. Finding jobs for newly graduated, overqualified but totally inexperienced aspiring adults was apparently Sarah's area of expertise. I put them back in the drawer and went to pull open the bottom one. Locked. For the first time, I saw the little round lock in the upper right-hand corner of this, the deepest drawer. Where was the key? I looked around the room. Every desk was the same. Would the keys be too? The facing desk was still unoccupied. Susan was still by the door, but leaning down to chat conspiratorially with someone sitting near it. I could guess what about. I quickly got up, went around to the other desk, and pulled out the small silver key from the lock in the bottom drawer. It was the kind you get with a cheap padlock. I sat back down at Sarah's desk and tried the key. It turned easily in the lock. I pulled on the drawer. The first thing I saw in there was my own face smiling up at me, a framed photo that Sarah must at some point have kept on her desk. In it, I was sitting on our couch, smiling at the photographer. Her. It was from a couple of years ago, at least. I turned it over and moved on to the rest. A travel mug with a quip about Monday mornings printed on it, a box of highlighter pens, a pack of 5 A4 refill pads still wrapped in plastic, a half-empty jar of hard candies with a sticker that read, "The Old Sweet Shop," a USB cup warmer shaped like a cookie, which I had given her last Christmas as a joke. Why bother locking any of this stuff away? I lifted up the pack of refill pads. There was a single envelope lying underneath, white and long with a window. A bill. It had already been opened and I pulled the contents out now. Saw the familiar O2 logo, Sarah's name, and our home address. It was her mobile phone bill. Sent to our apartment, brought into work, kept in a locked drawer. But why? I spread the pages across the desk. There were 4 of them, each printed front and back. The cover page had a summary of charges and showed the amount owed. The billing period, a line of bold text said, covered the month of July. The other pages showed Sarah what she had to pay for. Line after line of activity, arranged chronologically, calls to other O2 numbers, calls to other mobiles, text messages, media messages, the odd international text, data usage. And suddenly, I knew why. "How are we going to do this?" I said to Morsi. "We can't call them all." We had walked to the Parnell Bridge end of the South Mall and settled on a bench by the river. The sun was shining and the tide was low. The putrid stench of the muddy green water in the Lee wafted up our nostrils. "We don't have to." Morsi had pulled a pen from his backpack and was already leafing through the pages. "We should be able to narrow it down." He handed the pages to me. "Go through them and cross off any numbers you recognize, your own included." I did as I was told. Afterward, half the bill had lines through it. "Now what?" Morsi motioned for me to give him back the list. "Now," he said, "I'm going to call out each of the remaining numbers to you and you're going to type them into your phone. If they're in your contacts already, the owner's name will come up as soon as you press call. That should get rid of a few more. Just try to hang up before they ring, or we'll be here all day with people seeing the missed call and ringing you back." Using this method, We managed to eliminate several more numbers, including those for Sarah's parents, a couple of her friends, and common contacts such as our landlord and the management company who looked after our apartment block. But that still left many unknowns. "What we need," Morsi said, "is a time. These are all stamped with time of day, date, and duration. When would it have been unusual for Sarah to be making a call or sending a text message? Can you think of a time?" I knew instantly. Saturday night. It was the one evening a week when we were almost guaranteed to be together, home alone. The going away party had been our first time out together in weeks, so the four Saturday nights in July were probably safe bets. Possibly Sarah had gone out with the girls on the first one, but that left three when I was all but positive we both were home, both watching TV, both making a conscious effort to stay off our phones. Phones during TV time annoyed us both. I took the bill back from Morsi and started scanning. Only one number had been called after 8 o'clock on the night of Saturday the 13th, but it turned out to be a driver for a pizza delivery. We had missed his call and Sarah had called him back. On the evening of Saturday the 20th, she had called her mother twice. The second call was short, as if she had forgotten something the first time around. And later, she had sent a string of text messages to Rose. But on the night of Saturday the 27th, a night I could actually remember because we had spent it watching the end of the first season of The Bridge, Sarah had sent 17 text messages to the same number between 8:15 p.m. and 11:23 p.m. 17 texts. That was one side of a long conversation. "This is the guy," I said, tapping the paper. "It has to be. We were at home that night, watching TV. I would have noticed if she'd been using her phone that much. She must have sent them when I was in the bathroom, or when she was. Look." Morsi took the bill back and studied it. "There's calls to that number at other times," he said. "But not a lot. Mostly it's text messages, lots of them, sent mostly during the daytime while..." He glanced at me. "Well, she's at work." "So now what?" "Now you call him." My stomach clenched. Whether it was the toxic reek of this stretch of the River Lee, or the prospect of finding a real live man who had been having sex with my girlfriend, I didn't know. A combination of both, perhaps. "And say what, exactly?" "Just ask to speak to Sarah." I unlocked the screen on my phone. I shook my head, not quite believing that I was doing this. "He might hang up on you," Morsi said. "So I'd get in there quick with something about how worried her parents are and that you've gone to the Gardaí and stuff like that." "Why don't I just text him? Because we don't know if it's him yet." I slowly keyed in the number, double and triple checking that I'd entered it right. I looked at Morsi. He nodded encouragingly. "Okay," I said. "Here goes." I pressed call. It rang once. I got up and walked to the railing. Bad plan. There, the smell of the river was even worse. It rang again. Then, "Hello?" A man's voice. "Hello? Is someone there?" An American accent. He had an American accent. I said nothing. I couldn't say anything. My mouth had gone dry, my mind blank. Well, almost blank. There was something in there. An image of Sarah and this man together, naked in tangled sheets. I turned to Morsi, who was looking at me questioningly. He motioned with his hands. "Is he there?" I nodded. "Then talk to him." I needed to find out who this man was. I was supposed to ask to speak to Sarah. Get it out as quickly as possible that her parents were very upset and that the Gardaí were involved. I took a deep breath, opened my mouth. "Sarah?" the man said. "Sarah, is that you?" I jerked my head away from the phone as if it burned. "Please, talk to me, Sarah." The voice was smaller now, tinny coming from the phone I was holding away from my ear. Just talk to me. Please. I threw the phone. It smacked up against the bench with a loud clack, bounced onto the pavement, and skidded beneath Morsi's legs. Adam, he said, getting up to retrieve it. What the... Sarah, is that you? Please talk to me, Sarah. Just talk to me. Please. Wasn't Sarah with him? If she wasn't, where was she? And why did he sound worried? You cracked the screen, Morsi said, handing me the phone. What happened? I don't know. The phone began to vibrate in my hand. Jesus Christ, he's calling back. I hit accept. Who is this? I said into the microphone. Who are you? Now it was my turn to listen to silence on the line. Where is she, you fucking prick? Her parents are worried sick. We've been to the Gardaí. If I don't find out what your name is, then they... A click, followed by a dial tone. He had hung up. Fucking prick, Morsi said. Way to stay calm, Ad. She's not with him. What? She's not with him. I repeated what the American guy had said. That's... Morsi shook his head. I don't get it. Neither do I. She's not with him, either. Does it make you feel better or worse? I don't know, I said. Better, I suppose, because she's not. Worse because we're back to square one. But why? I stopped. God, I am so sick of asking questions. I don't remember what it was like not to have a million of them running through my head constantly all the time. It's exhausting. Worse, I don't know when it's going to stop, if it is. This could just go on and on. This could... Fuck it, Morsi, this could be my life now. He slung an arm around my shoulders and patted my back. I miss her, I said, feeling tears sting my eyes. Just miss her. I know. Can you wake yourself up when you're having a nightmare? Like, can you tell it's just a dream? I've always been able to. I realize in the nightmare that I'm just asleep and I can wake up and the crazy guy with the knife or the T-Rex or whatever will stop chasing me. The T-Rex. I have a lot of Jurassic Park-based dreams. That's, weird. What I do is I force myself to make a loud noise, like shout out or moan or whatever, and that wakes me up. Nightmare over, just like that. I clicked my fingers. Do you think that would work for this? Morsi looked at me sadly. You should really talk to Rose. About what? About why? She blames me for this. Don't you think I have enough to deal with right now without having to listen to her litany of why I'm the world's worst boyfriend? I think she'd have more to tell you about Sarah than about you. It might help you understand. She said it was all my fault. She was upset, Ad. If you're not going to talk to Rose, what do you want to do now? Well, I don't want to, but I have to tell Mum and Dad. We're going to have to do what the Gardaí suggested. Put an appeal for information on Facebook and stuff. I don't want to give my mother a heart attack when she goes online to do telly bingo and sees Sarah's face staring up at her under the headline, Missing Person. But first, I tried calling him one more time. There was a long pause before a recorded female voice said, The person at this number is currently unavailable. Please try again later. I would never get through to that number again. It's Saturday morning, and Sarah is beside me in the bed. Her back is against my stomach. Her hair is long again. She's wearing the red dress. I whisper in her ear, but she doesn't stir. When I put a hand on her shoulder, I realize her skin is ice cold. I woke up with a start. I was in our bed alone. Even so, I had confined my limbs to my side of it while I slept. The room was dark, but for a sliver of sunlight pushing through a gap in the curtains. Had I managed to sleep through the night? An angry vibration from the nightstand signaled that I was getting an incoming call. I didn't remember putting the phone on silent, but then I didn't remember leaving myself a glass of water and a blister pack of Tylenol or a small bottle of Bach's Rescue Remedy or a packet of Kleenex. Mum had struck again. She and Dad had as good as moved in last night. She probably crushed up sleeping tablets and sprinkled them over that curry she forced me to eat. I picked up the phone. A blocked number. Could this be... I hit accept. Adam, it's Dan. Don't hang up. Dan. I pull myself up into a sitting position. Isn't it the middle of the night there? No. It's just after 9 in the morning. But that means it's... I pull the phone from my ear to check the time. 3 minutes after 2 in the afternoon. What the hell? Listen, sorry about the other day. I was just... That's why I'm calling. I'm not going to ask you what's going on, Adam. I don't want to know, because if I don't, it means I can look at this situation objectively and give you the advice you need. That's what you're paying me for. I don't know what's happening over there, but I do know this. The script needs to get to the studio by close of business Friday. I need to see it first, and we have to allow for changes to be made before I pass it on. You know what that means. That means I need the script right now. Yesterday, ideally, so I could have brought it home to read it over the weekend. I'm sorry, I just... How far in are you? Dan, the thing is that my girlfriend... I said I don't want to know. That's not me being a grade A asshole, Adam. I hope you understand that. I just want what's best for you. I want this to work out. I want to be able to tell you what you need to hear, not just what you want to. I understand, Dan, I do. I just don't know if there's going to be... There'll be no second chance here, Adam. You realise that, don't you? Yes. This is it. One shot. I know. Like the Eminem song. If you say so. LA is a small town when it comes to business, Dan said. People don't forget. They won't. I understand. A screenwriter gets his foot in the door with a spec, yeah, but he makes a career out of getting hired. Taking that one-word idea some idiot exec had in the shower this morning and turning it into a five-picture franchise. One of my clients, John Stacy, know him? He's locked in a sweat lodge out in the Arizona desert right now, turning the phrase Jungle Subway into a summer blockbuster. That's all the studio gave him, Adam. Two words, and they were Jungle and Subway. You only have to finish tweaking your own script. Who's going to hire someone who missed the deadline for rewriting his own script when there's the likes of John Stacy out there pulling untitled Jungle Subway project out of his ass for 100 against 300, complete with an ending that leaves the door open for a sequel or six? I understand that, Dan. I really do. But my advice is to do whatever you have to do to get this finished and get it finished on time. Switch your brain off, bottle your feelings, take something if you have to, just get it done. But you see, do you want all this to go away before it even gets started? No, of course, payment is on delivery. I know, it's just that right now, Kevin Williamson wrote Scream in a weekend. Actually, that's a myth. It was just the treatment. You don't even need to write anything new. You're rewriting 120 pages of mostly negative space. If you pulled out all the stops, you'd have this done in 2 or 3 days, and that's if you hadn't started it yet. But you have started it. A pause. Haven't you? course I have, I lied. But the thing is, my girl, whatever's happening over there, Adam, it's not going to be happening forever. It'll come to an end. This too shall pass. And what will you be left with then? Nothing, if you don't get this done. But Dan, it's serious. I'm hanging up now. I'll call again tomorrow, same time. Answer your phone when I do. You're going to thank me for this. But she's missing, Dan, okay? My girlfriend is missing. How am I supposed to think about a bloody screenplay when I don't know where my girlfriend is and haven't known for nearly a week? Silence. Dan. I pulled the phone from my ear. He'd hung up. Shit. I dialed Sarah's number. Sarah, for fuck's sake! I spat as soon as the voicemail kicked in. What the fuck are you doing? Call me when you get this message. Just call me, okay? I know you're checking your phone. I saw that you read the WhatsApp message. This has to stop. Your parents are in bits. The Gardaí are involved. I've just had Dan Goldberg on the phone. You know how much this means to me, how long I've waited for... The room blurred, and I realised I had tears in my eyes. Sarah, please. I don't know what's happening here. I don't know what to do. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Just call me. You don't have to talk to anyone but me. I won't even tell anyone we spoke if you don't want me to. But please, call me. Please. I took a breath. Sarah, you're scaring me. There was a gentle knock on the bedroom door. It swung open to reveal Rose carrying a steaming mug of something and a plate of toast. I quickly ended the call and put the phone down on the bed. Your mother sent me, she said. Can I come in? Sure. Did I hear you on the phone? My agent, I said. Don't ask. Rose handed me what I now saw was coffee. She placed the toast on the nightstand, pushing my mother's panic paraphernalia to one side so she could. It's good you slept so long, she said. You needed a rest. Any news? She shook her head. No, nothing. Something crashed in the kitchen. Who's out there? I asked. Your parents and Morsi. Jack and Maureen are on their way over. Your mother called them, apparently. She wants to force-feed them dinner, make sure they're okay. The substance in my cup was flecked with black flakes. Mum didn't drink coffee. If I had to guess, I'd say she prepared fresh grounds the way you were supposed to make instant. Rose moved to go. Wait, I said. Can we talk? After a beat, she sat down on the very edge of the bed. Morsi told me that Sarah read the WhatsApp message, she said. She did. And that she's not with the American guy. Doesn't look like it, no. She does love you, Adam. I laughed softly. Yeah. Seems like it, doesn't it? She does. But not like... Not in the same way she used to. She cares about you. Is she going to leave? Rose bit her lip. Yes. When? When the money comes in. Your money. When you can afford to live here by yourself. I looked around the bedroom. It had been a blank canvas when we moved in, and would still be if not for Sarah. She had bought the colourful bed linens, the coordinating bedside lamps, the floral art print that now hung on the opposite wall. The dressing table was home, only to a scented candle and a ceramic bowl filled with the various pieces of Sarah's costume jewellery. Her clothes took up most of the space in the wardrobe. Those were her paperbacks gathering dust on the windowsill. And yet, she wanted to leave this home. To leave me here, alone. Why? I asked. She isn't sure anymore that you two are the way it's supposed to be. You've been together for 10 years, Adam. 10 years. And she's only 29. She was 19 when she met you. I can do math too, Rose. Are you the same person you were when you were 19? Who else would I be? You know what I mean. Rose shifted her weight on the edge of the bed. Sarah and you, you've grown up since you first met. That's what you do in your 20s. If you do it with someone you met before any of that changing even began, well, what are the chances you'll both come out of the other side having grown into two people who still want to be together?
I did.
That makes one of you then.
Sarah and I had a deal.
Did she tell you that? You mean the arrangement whereby you had the luxury of avoiding the responsibilities of adulthood while the rest of us were forced to figure out how to carry them on our backs?
That one?
Yeah, she did tell me that. God, how nice it must be to be a man. No deadlines.
She waved her arms.
Here, have all the time you want.
I'll give Sarah all the time she wants too.
That's nice of you, but Mother Nature isn't as generous.
Rose waved her finger back and forth.
Tick-tock, biological clock. If you're a woman and you ever plan on having kids, your time to run off and have adventures and chase your dreams comes with a best-before date.
Sarah's worried about hers.
That's normal. You don't seem worried at all. I bet you haven't even thought about it.
That's not.
But why didn't she just talk to me about it? We could have figured this out.
I think her mind is made up.
Then why not just tell me?
She doesn't want to hurt you, Adam, or embarrass you.
And this isn't hurtful or embarrassing. If Sarah came in that door this minute and said she wanted to break up and you had to leave, where would you go?
I'd figure something out.
She was waiting until you wouldn't have to figure something out, until the money was in your account. Until you'd taken care of yourself. Could take care of yourself after she left you to your own devices.
Then where is she?
Hiding out until that happens.
I don't know where she is, Rose said. She was supposed to come back.
Why send the passport?
I don't know.
What does the note mean? Why hasn't she called?
She threw up her hands.
Adam, I don't know.
Do you think she's in trouble? I asked quietly.
The Gardaí don't seem to think so, Rose said after a beat.
That's not what I asked.
I think,
she drew a slow breath and let it out.
I think we're all going to be smacking ourselves in the forehead when we find out what's actually going on here. It's like the time a few years ago when my sister, she was just 19 or 20 then, didn't come home from a Saturday night out. My mother could never fall asleep until she did, so she lay awake 3, 4, 5 in the morning. She started calling her. Texting her phone, got no reply, no response. When it reached a reasonable hour, we called the friend she'd gone out with, and she'd told us she hadn't seen Ruth since they got separated in the club around midnight. Ruth had work at 11 and her uniform was at home, so when she hadn't come home by 10 o'clock, we were all worried sick. We rang the place where she worked as soon as they opened, thinking she might have gone straight there, but they hadn't heard from her either. She'd never missed a day of work in 2 years. My mother was literally just about to call the Gardaí when Ruth walked in the door looking for cash to pay the taxi driver. Her bag had been stolen in the club, so no phone, and she'd slept at a friend's. They were drunk, so they overslept.
She'd only woken up 15 minutes ago and had no idea we were all at home panicking, imagining a future of missing posters and underwater search teams. It was so real, Adam. My mother was about to dial 999. We were all convinced something awful had happened, and we started thinking it just because someone wasn't answering their phone. But absolutely nothing had happened.
Sarah's been gone a lot longer than a few hours.
I didn't say it was exactly the same.
What if she never comes home?
What would you have done if your sister didn't show up? Let's not indulge in the hypothetical, Rose said. Worry is the most pointless human emotion. Didn't anyone ever tell you that? Want to guess who told me that? I'll give you a clue. She wrote it in a thinking of you card she gave me back when I was convinced I'd fail my final year exams.
Yeah, well, I sighed. Easy for her to say. There was another knock at the door. Rose and I both looked toward the sound. This time it was Morsi, waving his iPad. I could see from the blue banner at the top of the screen that the device was logged onto Facebook.
Adam, he said, you need to see this.
Romain, Marie Leroy, Paris, 1993. The snow in Paris was different from the snow that had fallen over their old house. Out in the countryside, snow lay undisturbed on the ground for days, thick and pure. Here in the city, workers started plowing paths through it just as soon as it fell, and with so many people around, it didn't take long for what was left to turn into a dirty, slushy mess. The day before Christmas Eve, Romain picked his way through the slush en route to school. Temperatures had dropped to freezing overnight, so there was a good chance that some of what looked like harmless melted snow was actually rock-hard ice. He had reminded Maman again and again that he needed new winter boots, that he had outgrown the pair he wore last year, but unless it was something about Miki, which pills he was supposed to take at which time, how to clean the feeding tube when the battery on the back of his chair needed changing, nothing seemed to take root in her head these days. She would just forget. Just this morning he had told Papa, who promised to pick up a pair for him later on the way home from work. These would do in the meantime, he had said, pulling a pair of his own thick, knobbly woolen socks over Romain's sneakers. Just go slow, okay, and be careful. Romain did go slow, so slow he didn't get to school until after the bell. And he was careful, but the wetter the socks got, the more slippery the ground beneath them felt. Right outside the school gates, his left foot slid off the path and his balance went with it. He yelled out. He fell over. He hit the footpath hard, coming down on his right side. Tears sprang to his eyes. His hip throbbed. His elbow stung and the skin on both palms was scraped. Romain could feel the cold wetness of the snow seeping into his trousers. With a sinking feeling, he realized that when he stood up, he was going to look as if he had wet his pants. He pulled himself into a sitting position and waited for the pain to subside a bit. At least, he was late. Everyone else was inside already. The only thing that could make this worse was, "Hey, look, it's Romain the retard!" Bastien Pic was coming down the path, with two of his friends following behind. Bastien was in quatrième, 2 years ahead, and lived in the house across the street from Romain's. He was mean to all the boys in the younger classes. He was always getting into trouble with the teachers for it. But for some reason, he was especially mean to Romain.
"What the fuck happened to you?"
He was standing over Romain now, kicking him with one of his heavy boots.
"I think you've been spending a bit too much time with that little brother of yours. Should I go and get his wheelchair for you, or..."
A burst of laughter.
"Is it his nappies that you need?"
The other two boys started laughing, too. Romain tried to haul himself up, but Bastien pushed him down again.
"You better stay there," he said. "Wait for the retard ambulance to come and collect you." "Boys,"
one of the teachers was standing at the gates,
"what's going on over there?"
"Nothing, madame,"
Bastien called out. But when he turned to say this to her, he revealed Romain sitting on the ground. The teacher came rushing over.
"What happened? Are you all right?"
She helped Romain up, then turned to Bastien.
Are you trying to get another suspension?
Bastien held up his hands in a show of innocence.
I was just helping him up, Madame Berry.
Oh, you were you?
I was.
Bastien looked to his two goons for backup.
Wasn't I?
The two other boys nodded obediently. Madame Berry turned to Romain and demanded that he tell her what happened. Behind her, Bastien was glaring at him.
I want to go home, Romain said. Can I just please go home?
Tell me what happened first, and I want the truth.
Romain was cold and wet, and his side was really hurting. He just wanted to be back in his bedroom, to crawl under the blankets and wait in the darkness for Papa to finish work.
I fell on the ice, he said flatly. He was helping me up.
Romain, look at me.
Reluctantly, Romain lifted his eyes.
Now tell me again, what happened here?
I fell on the ice, he repeated.
Bastien was just helping me.
See? Bastien snarled. I told you!
Madame Berry ordered Bastien and the other two boys inside, then helped Romain into the school and to the principal's office. He could walk okay, but the pain in his side was getting worse. They told him they had called his mother and that she was going to come pick him up. He was to wait for her in a chair outside the principal's office. They gave him a cup of hot chocolate to drink and a scratchy blanket to put around his shoulders and told him his mother wouldn't be long. They lived only a few streets away. She shouldn't have been long, but Maman took more than an hour to get there, and when she did, she didn't ask him how he was or what had happened. She just hurriedly thanked the principal's secretary, grabbed Romain's hand, and said they had to hurry back because it was nearly time for Mickey's bath. Christmas was okay. Romain got a PlayStation and some new books and clothes. Jean got a set of WWF action figures he had yet to leave out of his sight. He was even sleeping with them. Mickey had what Maman called a good day, which meant that nothing went wrong with his chair or his medicine or his food and that he remained calm for the most part and didn't get stressed or agitated. It was his first Christmas at home. He had been staying at a special hospital for kids like him until a few months ago. That was where they had moved from the countryside to be closer to him. Now they were all back together, and Romain suspected that this was why even Maman seemed to be in a good mood. She drank wine in the evening with Papa and hadn't gotten upset or shouted at anyone. A deep purple bruise had spread all over Romain's right side, but it didn't really hurt any more. Not as much as it had, anyway. He hadn't shown it to anyone.
Hey, Romy, Papa said to him the day after Christmas, I hear the park is opening again this morning, and all the kids are in there making as many snowmen as they can. They are trying to build an army of them. Want to head down there?
Romain shook his head. If all the kids really were there, that meant Bastien Pic probably was too.
Why not? Papa asked.
It's cold.
Building snowmen is hard work. You'll soon warm up.
I don't want to build snowmen.
Then you can just watch.
Romain shook his head again.
Ah, come on, Papa said. It'll be fun. You can take Jean with you.
At the mention of his name, Jean looked up from his action figures. The toys were all laid out on the living room floor around a plastic wrestling ring, except for one which was lying flat on its back inside it. Pink and black gear, Brett the Hitman Hart.
I don't want to go,
Jean whined.
Listen, boys, you two have been stuck inside since school ended. You need to get outside. Romy, what did I buy those boots for? It wasn't to keep your feet dry on the living room carpet. And Jean, you can take the wrestlers with you. They can fight on the ice, can't they?
No,
Jean said sullenly. But Papa was adamant that they go outside for a while. He dressed them both in heavy layers, slipped Romy a few francs so they could buy sweets in the shop, and told them to stay out for at least a half hour. It was all a bit strange, but Romain did what he was told. He always did nowadays. The two boys dutifully trudged their way to the park. It was only a 5-minute walk from their house. Romain got Jean to walk on the inside of the footpath, away from the road, and held his hand the whole way. The park was full of kids, and they were all building snowmen. Romain counted nearly 20 of them in the open area just inside the gates. Some had accessories, scarfs, hats, carrots, twigs, coals. The park had been closed yesterday, and so the snow had had a chance to build up, white and thick. It reminded him of how the garden around the old house used to look during winter. Jean had no interest in the snow or snowmen. He just wanted to play with his action figures. Romain suggested that they cut through the park to the shop, buy some sweets, and then start back home again. If they walked slowly, it would take the half hour that Papa had insisted they stay out for.
"What about the ice?" Jean asked.
"What ice?"
"Papa said I could play wrestling on the ice."
Well, Romain looked around. The pond was straight ahead. They could skirt around it to get to the exit by the shop. It would take a little longer, but that would only please Papa.
"Okay, come on. Just for a minute, though. I want to get back."
The pond wasn't frozen, only frozen over. The layer of ice on its surface was thin and translucent and full of cracks and gaps. There was no one around. Over the shallow part of the edge, the ice was fairly thick, so Romain told Jean he could put his figures there.
"You stay on the path, though. Don't go on the pond. Only the wrestlers can do that, okay?"
Jean nodded.
"Okay."
He crouched down and started organizing the figures on the ice.
"I don't believe it," a voice said. "You again!"
It was Bastien Pic, coming toward them along the side of the pond. Alone, but then his stupid henchmen were never too far away.
"Jean," Romain said, "sorry, but we have to go."
"But the referee hasn't even rung the bell."
"You can have that match at home. Come on."
Bastien was on them now. He looked down at Jean.
"How many of you retards are there?"
Jean's face fell.
"Leave him alone," Romain said.
"Oh, leave him alone,"
Bastien put on a high-pitched, girly voice.
"You want me to leave him alone?"
He stepped toward Romain until his face was inches away. He was close enough that when he spoke, Romain felt droplets of saliva hit his face.
"You don't fucking tell me what to do, okay? Don't even think about it."
In a small voice, Jean said,
"Romy, we are going now, Jean. Pick up your toys."
"You're not going anywhere," Bastien said. "You know I got detention over you, you little shit. I didn't even do anything. You're the idiot who fell. When I saw you leave your house a while ago, I thought now was a good time to collect what you owe."
Romain said nothing. He thought of the money Papa had given them for sweets. Was that what Bastien meant?
"Romy,"
Jean said again.
"If I'm going to get in trouble for kicking your pathetic ass," Bastien said, "I should at least get to kick it."
No, he didn't mean money. He was going to beat Romain up.
"Romy,"
Jean said.
"Romy, what's..."
Bastien swung around and roared,
"Will you just shut the fuck up?"
Jean's eyes grew wide with fright. Then his face crumpled. He looked at Romain helplessly as a dark stain began to spread between his legs. Bastien started laughing.
"No way! Seriously! You're not toilet trained either!"
The elastic snapped. That was how Romain would describe it later. That was the only way he could. It was as if everything he had been keeping inside since Mickey's accident, all the times he had held back his anger at the shit he took from Bastien and the other boys, all the words he'd had to swallow so he could try his best to be good, all of it had been bundled up, hidden away, kept back, held tight inside this stretch of elastic. And where had it gotten him? All but ignored by Maman. Bullied at school. Bastien hadn't been the first. And now here was poor Jean, shouted at, frightened and humiliated all by this dumb, mean shit smear of a... Romain pulled his right arm back and punched Bastien as hard as he could in the face. After that, everything seemed to happen in slow motion. His fist connected with the underside of Bastien's jaw and kept going, into the soft flesh on the side of his neck. Bastien's eyes widened in surprise and he fell backward over the edge of the pond. Jean grabbed his action figures just before the thin layer of ice they were on smashed with the force of the impact. The rage roared like a fire through Romain's veins. He didn't feel like himself. It felt as if he were standing a few feet away, watching himself from afar. He lifted his boots over the edge of the pond and stepped into the shallow water on the other side. He felt like a giant towering over Bastien. He felt strong. Impossibly strong, as though he could snap the boy's neck if he really wanted to. Bastien was sitting in water up to his armpits. He was splashing around, trying to get up, but already the icy water was affecting his breathing. He had started to pant loudly. He looked up at Romain, confused and scared.
"What the hell are you?"
Romain bent over and pushed Bastien back down under the surface, both hands on the boy's neck, a knee digging into his chest. Behind him on the path, Jean started to wail. Romain could feel Bastien thrashing under the water, trying to come up. His hands were above the surface, smashing at it desperately, sending icy droplets flying everywhere and making splashing sounds, clawing at the skin on the back of Romain's hands. Still, Romain held him under. He did it until the thrashing stopped. Then, tentatively, he lifted his knee. No movement. He released his hands from the boy's neck. Still none. He pulled his hands out of the water and looked down at them, turning them over, studying the palms. They were turning blue with the cold, and the skin on the pads of his fingers was all crinkly. He looked beyond them into the water. Bastien's gray face was floating beneath the surface, eyes open wide. And Romain was suddenly back inside his own skin. He wasn't watching from afar anymore. This was happening. This was real. He looked at Jean, then back at Bastien, then back at Jean again. What had he done now? Romain got out of the water, grabbed his brother's hand, and ran the two of them out of the park and all the way home. At first, it seemed as though the house was empty. Maman had taken Miki to the hospital for an appointment. Romain knew that. But where was Papa? He called out for him but got no answer. The TV was on in the living room. Papa wouldn't have gone out without turning it off, would he? So where? Romain saw him then out the window. Papa was in the back garden stringing netting between the poles of a trampoline. A new trampoline. That's why he had sent them out of the house. As he watched Papa prepare a surprise for them, Romain realized that he had ruined everything. Again! He had let the darkness out just for a minute and destroyed everything. Again! Jean lifted his hand to knock on the glass, but Romain stopped him.
Don't, he said. He put a finger to his lips. Be quiet, okay? We are going to sneak upstairs. We can't make any noise, though. It's a game.
They went to their room and changed into clean, dry clothes of similar colors to the wet ones, hoping Papa wouldn't notice the difference. He would notice if their winter boots were missing, though, so they stuck their feet into the plastic bags Mama put in the bin in the bathroom before sliding them inside their soaking wet boots again. Jean carefully transferred his wrestlers from the pockets of his wet coat to the dry one he had on now.
Romy, he said, where's Bret Hart?
What?
Bret Hart isn't here.
Are you sure?
He's not here.
Jean's voice started to rise.
He's not here.
Jean, please, be quiet. Don't forget the game. I promise I'll get you another one, okay?
But I want the one I had. Where is he?
Maybe you dropped him on the road outside. We'll go look, okay?
Romain put all the wet clothes in his gym bag and stuffed it down in the back of the wardrobe. Then he went to the window. Papa was still outside. The trampoline was nearly assembled. They hurried down the stairs and back out the front door, walked around the block a couple of times and came back, this time ringing the doorbell.
Boys,
Papa said when he pulled back the door.
How was the park? Did you have fun? Did you build a snowman?
Before they could answer, he beckoned them down the hall.
I have a little surprise for you. Well, a big one. It's out in the garden. Papa Noel was supposed to bring it, but it got delayed at customs, so?
Behind Papa's back, Romain and Jean exchanged a glance. Romain put a finger to his lips. After a moment's hesitation, Jean nodded his head just once, in silent agreement. By the next morning, Bastien's disappearance was all over the news. Policemen were all over the neighborhood. Parents were getting together, conducting searches. Papa said he wanted to go, but Maman stopped him, saying he was needed more at home. Mickey was having a bad day. The battery pack on his chair kept beeping, and Maman couldn't figure out why. She was worried that it might go off at any moment. If it did, they would have to run to the hospital. Papa wasn't going anywhere. Romain sat in the living room with him, watching the TV. The local news channel showed jerky helicopter footage of people walking through the snowy streets, across the school grounds, checking in ditches and drains, rifling through bins. Bastien's parents stood on their doorstep, holding each other and crying, pleading for information about their son's whereabouts. A heavy lump settled in the pit of Romain's stomach. Dread was seeping out of every pore on his skin. It would be only a matter of time before they found the body. He wondered whether he should just run away, but he couldn't think of a single place to go. Why had he done that awful thing? Another one! To protect Jean. Where was Jean? He had been avoiding Romain all day, but that was understandable, although he wasn't sure whether Jean had really understood what he had seen. Maybe he was scared of his big brother now. Or maybe he was just playing with those damn wrestlers. Which reminded him he had to go get another Bret Hart. He had some pocket money saved up. It would be enough. He just didn't know where to get one. He would have to figure it out. The announcement came just after lunch. Bastien Pique's body had been found in the pond in the park. Police were looking to speak with anyone who had been in or around the park between lunchtime and 6 o'clock the day before. There had been a large crowd building snowmen. Were you or any of your children one of them? They were particularly interested in speaking to anyone who had lost an American wrestling action figure in or around the area by the pond. Apparently, Bastien had been found with one on his person, even though he didn't own such a thing himself. The TV screen went blank. Papa had turned it off with the remote. An American wrestling action figure, he repeated. In the park. Romain held his breath as his father's head turned slowly toward him. Romy. It was just one word, but it was soaked in sadness. Romain didn't dare turn to face his father. He couldn't. After Mickey, Papa was the only one who had stood up for him, who had defended him to Maman. She wanted to send him away. She wanted him punished. She never wanted to see him again. I knew something was wrong with him. Didn't I always say it? Didn't I? And you told me to calm down. But Papa had made her see that Romain was just a child just trying to help, copying what he'd seen grown-ups do, not understanding his mistake. Papa had understood what really happened with Mickey. But would he this time? Romain could say it was an accident, that Bastien had been saying things to Jean when he slipped and fell. What would be Romain's excuse for not helping him, though, for not running to get help? He could say he was scared. He had been scared. That was the truth. Romy, Papa said again.
Romy, did you?
The door to the kitchen swung open. Maman stood on the threshold, tears running down her face. She looked angry and scared and sad all at the same time. She was holding the gym bag of wet clothes in her hand. Jean was holding her other hand. He was standing just behind her, against her leg, hiding, almost, in the folds of her skirt, sucking his thumb just as he used to when he was younger. He wouldn't look at Romain.
The police are on their way, she said to Romain. What?
Papa stood up.
What are you talking about?
He knows,
Mama spat, nodding at Romain.
You can ask him. And don't you dare speak to me. I listened to you the last time, and look what's happened now. He is not a boy, Charlie. I've tried time and time again to tell you that. He nearly killed Mickey, and now he's actually killed that boy. He did it in front of Jean.
Papa looked bewildered. Romain started to cry. Jean tugged on Mama's hand and said,
Now can we go get the new Brett out?
Adam. I know it's unlikely, I read aloud, and my husband said I shouldn't be bothering you, but she had a Cork accent and said her name was Sarah. She was on her own for dinner, sat next to us. The Pavilion restaurant only has tables for 12, and they fill them up as guests arrive. I saw on your post that your Sarah was on a flight from Cork to Barcelona last Sunday, and so were we. I didn't see her on it, though. Then we boarded the Celebrate from Barcelona early Monday morning. Now, I might be wrong, God forgive me, but I'm convinced it was the same girl. Her hair was different, though, short like a boy's. I'm sorry I don't have any other information for you, because we only chatted about the ship. Paul and I had been on the maiden voyage too, so we were giving her tips about what to do and where to go. That sort of thing. And then I didn't see her again. But it's a huge ship. 2,000 passengers it can take. We stopped in Nice in France and La Spezia in Italy, and then went back to Barcelona again. Disembarked Thursday morning, 3 nights, 4 days. You can contact me if you think I could be of any help, but as I said, that's really all I know, and maybe I'm wrong. I'll say a novena for you all anyway. Regards, Mary Marr. I look up from my phone. Cusack was sitting on the other side of the conference table with an expression that seemed to say, And? Then she actually said it. The logo, Maureen reminded me. Oh, yeah. I slide an A4 page across the table. Half of it was taken up with a photo of a middle-aged couple posing in front of a mural of a large cruise ship. The image was streaked with white lines. My printer was running low on ink. This is Mary and her husband on the ship. I tapped the bottom right-hand corner of the picture where a logo had been superimposed. See that? I opened Sarah's passport to the photo page, where the note was still stuck. I laid it flat on the table, aligned it with the photograph. The squiggly lines, they're waves. That's the Blue Wave logo. That's the company that owns the Celebrate. Sarah must have gotten that paper when she was on the ship. To my left, Jack blew air out of his nose. When I turned to look at him, I saw his lips set in a tight line and his arms folded across his chest. He looked annoyed, but with who? With Sarah? With me? So this message, Cusack said, it came from the Facebook page. Yeah. On Friday night, Morsi had set up a Help Us Contact Sarah O'Connell Facebook page. By Saturday afternoon, a Tipperary woman named Mary Marr had sent a private message to it, saying she had just returned from a Mediterranean cruise where she met a woman she thought was Sarah. Mary Sarah had a Cork accent and very short hair, and the ship, the Celebrate, had made a stop in Nice from where the passport had been posted. But still, a cruise ship? Why would Sarah have gone on one of those? The Facebook page's inbox was quickly filling up with similarly ridiculous claims. The message that came in just before Mary's claimed that Sarah had been buying a trolley load of ice in Tesco, Mahon Point, Thursday morning, and the one after was from a psychic who told us, hey, bad news, Sarah is dead, but good news, if you cough up €200 in cash, you can communicate with her across the ether. But then, when Morsi went and looked at Mary's Facebook profile, he saw that she had just updated her cover photo with an image taken aboard the ship. He recognized the logo instantly. We had messaged Mary back, then later spoke to her for a few minutes over the phone. Next, we called Garda Cusack to tell her we had new information and she agreed to move our planned Monday meeting up. Now it was Sunday morning. We were back in the same stuffy conference room in the district HQ on Anglesey Street, and Cusack was not reacting to this the way I thought she would. In fact, she was barely reacting at all to the news that we had traced Sarah to a cruise ship in the Mediterranean. Cusack picked up the printout of the photo now, brought it close to her face, studied it, put it down again, picked up the passport, flicked through its pages, stopped on one page, raised an eyebrow, rotated the passport to get a better look at whatever was there. I found the, friend, too, I said. I got his number from Sarah's phone bill. She isn't with him. I have his number if you want it, but I haven't been able to get through to it since Thursday. Cusack said nothing. And she read the message, I said, pushing on, the WhatsApp message I sent her. Its status is red now. I think she read it Wednesday night or early the next morning. And we know for sure she called in sick to work, so... That's good, Cusack said. That's all good news. But I'm a bit confused. What is it you think we can do for you at this point? Well, we need you to confirm that she was on the ship, I said, swallowing the word, obviously. We called Blue Wave, but they won't give out any passenger information. They must know where she got off, when she got off, who she was with, whether she reported to them that her passport had been lost or stolen while she was there. Or maybe she had an accident or got sick during the cruise and had to be transferred to a hospital. I felt Maureen beside me reacting to this scenario. You could find out who owns the phone number, the one for Sarah's friend. Find out who it's registered to. We can't do that ourselves. I'm not sure we can do that either, Cusack said. You said Sarah isn't with him? She's not with him now, no. What about the police in Nice, Maureen asked, and the consulate? You said you were going to check with them. Have you heard anything? Has Sarah been to any of them? When are you actually going to... Maureen's voice rose. Start doing something about finding my daughter! Jack put a hand on his wife's arm. I couldn't tell whether he was comforting her or shushing her. I know this is difficult for you, Cusack said gently, and confusing. But as I explained when we first met on Friday, we don't go looking for every capable adult who goes somewhere without telling anyone else. We don't send out search parties for people who turn off their phone. And we don't open missing persons cases unless there's a real concern that the person who can't be contacted has come to harm, could come to harm, or has plans to harm themselves. I don't see any evidence for any of that here. And that's a good thing, she exhaled. Now, let me tell you what I do see. On Gardaí, it turned out, had their own names for things. We sat and listened while Cusack translated the events of the past week into Garda speak. Sarah telling work she was sick, telling me she was going to a conference and not telling her parents anything at all, became purposely misleading loved ones about her whereabouts. Withdrawing €650, the odd €3, Cusack explained, was the foreign ATM transaction fee, constituted having means, and withdrawing cash instead of using her card was